You've probably noticed how much Tara and Lydia, neither of whom are here tonight, enjoy playing Heidi and Chasey games under the table while we're eating supper on Sunday nights. Actually, this is a little bit of a variation on an older tradition in our church, which I think was begun, as far as I know, by Acacia when she was about two. A tradition of crawling under the communion table during worship and sitting in that little space underneath there. And somehow it was passed on so that for a number of years, most of our children aged somewhere around age two or three have made a practice of going and sitting in that space under the communion table. It may be because of the age gap that occurred that Tara has been the first one to be here at that age and not pick up that tradition, but she has pursued her own variation on it under the supper table. I think I might have seen Sophia under the supper table a few times too, just quietly. Perhaps the scene in tonight's gospel reading might shed some light on the nature of this particular ritual game under the table. "Sir, even the dogs under the table eat the children's crumbs." Now, I don't think any of our kids have had to contend with any hungry dogs for space or crumbs under the table, but perhaps, like the Syrophoenician woman in the story, they have been claiming their place at the table in what may have been the only way they knew how. Admission to the table has been a big issue in the church throughout its 2,000 years of history. We've had many a dispute over who can and can't come to the table. What preparation does a person have to do before being accepted at the table? What initiation rites must they first undergo? How old must someone be to be welcomed to the table? How much must they know and understand? And then, of course, also the removal of a person's right of access to the table has been a major form of punishment in the church's disciplinary procedures. It's called excommunication. And it's usually been reserved for particularly serious sins or heresies. But there are lesser forms of mild excommunication too. You may remember the rainbow sash movement and the controversies that they caused in the Roman Catholic Church here in Australia when gay Catholic Christians presented themselves to receive communion from the Archbishop while wearing rainbow sashes to identify themselves as gay and as challenging the Church's condemnation of their sexuality. They were not officially excommunicated, but the Archbishop of the day ruled that they could not be served communion from the table while they were wearing the sashes, because the wearing of them was an open defiance of the Church's teaching and thus ruled them out at the time. Now, this question of the rights and wrongs of table fellowship is not a new issue created by the Church. It existed before that too. In fact, it's quite a lot older than the church, and most cultures have had fairly clear expectations of who can eat at the same table as who. Sharing a meal is always and always has been a powerful statement of acceptance and belonging and mutual respect. And limitations of who one can eat with have been powerful markers of the boundaries between people. So for the Jewish community to which Jesus belonged, the kosher food laws and the laws against eating with Gentile people were crucial components of their endeavours to maintain a distinctive Jewish identity in a pluralistic Greco-Roman world. So we Christians inherited that history, and we continue to understand the table as an important place for defining who we are and how we are distinct and different from others. And of course, once you define yourself as distinct and different, it's only a very short step to seeing yourself as superior to others. and as belonging to God's favourites, and seeing others as inferior and rejected by God, and therefore to be shunned and avoided by us. So it's into that sort of system of understandings that the Syrophoenician woman in tonight's story speaks. She has come to Jesus not seeking a meal, but seeking his help to heal her daughter. But because sharing food is such a major symbol of the boundaries that separated her as a Gentile woman from him as a Jewish man, food quickly became the metaphor for the negotiation of their relationship. "Let the children be fed first," says Jesus, "for it's not fair to take the children's food and throw it to the dogs." Sounds shockingly offensive to our ears, but it probably wouldn't have raised an eyebrow at the time. The understanding was that the gifts of God are for the chosen people of God, and that they are dishonoured if they are shared with those who are not worthy, the outsiders, the excluded, the excommunicated. Now, just what was going on for Jesus when he said this is impossible to be sure about. Did he have a bad day and a mindless moment and thoughtlessly repeat a common saying? Was he reflecting the racist assumptions that he'd grown up with? And this is actually the moment, this story is the moment when he recognises them and repents of them. Or was he playfully setting up a straw man and inviting the woman to knock it down with him so that all might see the world from a new perspective? It's impossible to be sure, and I don't want to dwell on the question tonight, although I have done so when preaching on this passage in previous years, and if you want to see what I've said about that question of what Jesus is doing there, it's available on the website. But I want to go in another direction with it this time round. The woman answered him, "Sir, even the dogs under the table eat the children's crumbs." In that culture, the woman has taken a huge risk here. She is a Gentile woman facing a Jewish male rabbi, and she dares to speak back to him, taking his own words and turning them back on him as she continues to call on him to do something that he has already said he is not going to do. And what she is doing with her daring back chat is suggesting that God's table is not really so closed as Jesus might be making out, but that people like her, people long excluded, have a right to come to God's table and to expect to be able to receive and eat and be satisfied. And Jesus says to her, "Right you are, sister. And for saying that, what you were looking for has been given to you. Go home and you'll find that your daughter is well." Now, we are understandably shocked that Jesus calls the woman a dog. But in his day, the big shock of the story would have been a male Jewish rabbi conceding an argument to a presumptuous Gentile woman. That would have been what shocked hearers then. And that he would not only concede it, but commend her for it. There are probably a number of implications that we could draw from that, but let me just pick out one. Jesus is recognising, and so calling us as his followers to recognise, that we have much to learn from those who know the experience of being the excluded ones. It is crucial to our understanding of Jesus that we see how fully he entered into the experience of the victims, the excluded, the outcast. He died an innocent victim, excluded and cast out. Only the victims can know fully what it means to be on the wrong end of the world's prejudices and hostilities. And having revealed how radically God identifies with that experience, Jesus calls us to follow him in opening ourselves to the insights and wisdom and spirituality that are only born of that experience of exclusion. Perhaps it's no accident that in the very next story, which we also heard in the reading tonight, Jesus heals a man who was deaf and dumb. We need to have our ears open so that we might hear what God would have us hear. And until we do, we have nothing to say, or at least nothing worth saying. And so for us in the churches, we will be sure to miss the point if we argue and debate about, for example, the place of homosexual people at the table of God's love without opening ourselves up to real conversations with homosexual people and listen to the insights that are born of their experience of exclusion and hostility. Similarly, if we want to discuss reconciliation for Indigenous people, we had better not come with a colonialist mindset again and try and impose reconciliation. We need to listen and seek to understand from their experience. And if we want to explore questions of our relationship with people of other faiths, we'll be talking in ignorant circles if we don't first make some friends with some Hindu or Muslim neighbours and listen and learn what it is like to be other in a country where being people of faith is normally assumed to mean Christian. I could go on. Asylum seekers, people with mental illnesses or physical disabilities, whoever. Jesus invites us to join him in allowing ourselves to be taught by those whose experience of policies of exclusion is as the excluded, not as the excluders. And perhaps as we learn from these various voices, we will begin to more fully and deeply understand what this woman asserted and what Jesus' subsequent response confirmed, that the Lord's table, the cosmic banqueting table of God's love and mercy, is far more radically open than we could ever imagine. It is so radically open that it will continue to shock and bewilder us. It is so radically open that almost any time we think we should be policing the boundaries and keeping someone away, we will almost certainly be wrong. St. Augustine warned that there were some in the church intent on severe disciplinary precepts who admonish us to rebuke the restless and not to give what is holy to dogs and to consider a despiser of the church as a heathen and to cut them off from the unified structure of the body, to cut off that member who causes scandal. And he went on to say, "These people may so disturb the peace of the church that they try prematurely to separate the wheat from the chaff before the proper time, and blinded by this pretext, they themselves become separated from the unity of Christ." The scandalously open table of the Lord is an enormous comfort whenever we have felt that we might be deserving of exclusion ourselves. God invites us, deserving or not, and welcomes us to feast on the bread of mercy and to drink from the cup of love. But at other times, that openness is just as much a confronting and uncomfortable challenge, because God's reckless generosity extends to people that we don't like and don't trust, people who offend us and who seem to be beyond the pale and beyond hope. And I suspect that the only way to miss out on a place at God's table is to refuse to be seated with the undeserving others that are seated there. And of course, if we think that we are deserving, we're probably deluding ourselves. And in truth, our right to be at the table is no less a gift of far-reaching grace than anybody else's. So I don't want us to ever prevent our children from practicing their tradition of playing under the table. But I do want to say to them that they are not only allowed under the table, they are allowed to come out and stand at the table alongside the rest of us. For what God wants is to feed them not just on the crumbs that fall from what is given to others. God wants to feed them on the full banquet of love and mercy that all of us feed from. God offers to them and to all of us, the deserving and the undeserving, the understanding and the ignorant, young and old, straight and gay, local and foreigner, to all of us, God offers and welcomes us to the full banquet of love and mercy and reconciliation and life. So come out from under the table and feast.